Подождите аплодировать, может, вам не все понравится еще.
Большая пресс-конференция президента России.
Почему падают рейтинги? Почему растет в обществе?
Предельными, неадекватными и, извините, людоедскими.
Довольно жесткий, где-то даже авторитарный режим личной
власти.
Вам
это нравится? Вы садомазохист, что ли?
It was hyped like a Hollywood blockbuster. It lasted more than 4 hours. And when it was over, its content was dissected and parsed like an ancient text. Opposition journalists spent a good deal of time after Vladimir Putin's annual press conference on Thursday patting themselves on the back for their bravery in asking the president tough questions. The Kremlin and its many surrogates spent the day praising Putin's performance, insisting that he's back in top form. And as political theater, the event certainly had its moments. Putin was questioned about his health. There was sparring over a bill banning U.S. citizens from adopting Russian children and about the Kremlin's harsh crackdown on dissent. There were also odd moments, like when Putin claimed to know when the world will end. And in case anybody's wondering, it's not today, but 4.5 billion years in the future. Live from Moscow, it's the Vladimir Putin Show. It was long, at times it was even entertaining, and it may have even given us some clues about where Russia may be going. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFVRL. In the studio with me in Prague is Kirill Kobrin of RFVRL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor Mark Galliotti, an expert on Russia's security services and author of the must-read blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome back, Mark.
Hi there.
This event, this thing, it was played up on Russian television like it was the Super Bowl or the World Cup final. And in the post-game show, both sides were claiming victory. I want to ask both of you the same question. What do you think the Kremlin's goals were going in? How successful was the president in achieving those goals? And was the opposition, or the opposition journalists, for that matter, was their self-congratulations justified? Mark, let's start with you.
Well, it's interesting that you raised the blockbuster analogy, because I must admit it was a test of endurance, and in many ways I wish it had been released as a trilogy instead. And much like Lord of the Rings, I think the basic message is it's the return of the king. I think the key message from the Kremlin's point of view was exactly that the king is back, he is healthy, and he is most certainly in command. And on that level, on a micro scale, it worked. He did display a few suggestions of discomfort that might reflect his back injury. But broadly speaking, it was very much the old Putin. So if you're actually talking about what happened in that room, yes, it was very much a return to the old commanding czar. The difference is actually, though, that the situation outside the room has changed, and we can talk more about the context later. So on a macro scale, I don't think it was successful, even though Putin certainly did his part. From the opposition's point of view, well, yes, we definitely heard from a Russian media that in between bouts of quite embarrassingly fawning regard for the Tsar, everything from suggesting that the Kuril should be called after him to noting his energy and his beauty, there were real questions being raised. He was, I know we'll be talking more about this later, but he was pressed 8 times on the adoption bill and such like. But again, I think you have to be wary of calling journalists who are doing their job the opposition. Things haven't quite got to that pitch in Russia at the moment. I think it's more that it demonstrates that society is no longer in control, I think, and that's definitely an encouraging development.
Although journalists doing their job in Russia certainly is subversive. Kirill, what was your takeaway?
When I watched this press conference, it's a little bit academic and unexpectedly, but I thought about Austrian philosopher Ludwig Wittgenstein.
Of course you did.
Yes.
Because
one of his main philosophical ideas was that philosophy is not about inventing some, you know, new things, concepts and ideas and so on. The main task of a philosopher, from the point of view of Ludwig Wittgenstein, was to repeat the obvious things, but to put them in a perfect order. The most possible, you know, perfect order. And during this press conference, Putin played a role of this Wittgenstein philosopher, ideal philosopher, because all the things that he told and all, you know, his manner, his intonation and his attitude to journalists and to public and so on was just repeating what we know about him. He was at the same time a little bit, and sometimes not a little bit, insulting to those who asked.
We'll get to that in a minute.
He was quite, you know, his self-esteem was quite high. And at the same time, and it's very important, one of the main features of his presentation usually, and now it was, you know, more numerous cases in, during this speech and this press conference, that he cannot answer, you know, a direct question. He was asked about this and this and this, and his answer was as for
that,
for instance,
and that and that.
I don't know the text of the document.
Mm-hmm.
So it's ridiculous how a president of the country couldn't, you know, be informed about the text of this important...
He was leaving himself an out, and we'll get to... Yeah, that was on
yes,
the
and so on.
Bill.
But from the point of view of, you know, public politics, public relations, and so on, this, in every, you know, Western country, such answer is disastrous.
Mm-hmm.
He's not competent enough to be a leader of the country.
I don't know. I've seen plenty of Western politicians play that game. From the point of view of political theater, was it a success or a failure for Putin, do you think?
It was the repeating of the obvious thing, that he is playing the same game.
But does that achieve their goals? If we assume their goals were to kind of show that Putin is back in his old form, which I'm pretty sure that was the goal. I'm not sure that Volodin and Peshkov told him to act to be a Wittgenstein philosopher, but I'm pretty sure they did want to show that the king is back.
Yes,
were they successful in that?
I read a lot of expert opinions about the outcome of this press conference and so on, and the most popular among them is that is a brilliant victory of Dmitry Peskov, his press secretary, not Volodin, Peskov.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about, you know, a play, a drama, which we saw on TV or computer screens. But it's not about, you know, the content of this. Mm-hmm. I understand clearly that, of course, press conferences and public speeches are not, it's not the most important things from the point of view of content. It's all about, you know, publicity and so on. But anyway, all these things, they have to include some, you know, pieces of content.
Right. Well, actually, and you actually give me an opportunity to segue where I wanted to go now. I mean, as I wrote in the blog kind of previewing this podcast, this was all about optics. And one of the takeaways I came away from with this was how different this was from previous press conferences in terms of how Putin interacted with the journalists and how, more importantly, how journalists interacted with Putin.
Yeah.
I want to play a brief clip from the press conference in which Putin addressed an adult journalist, Maria Solovyenko, by her diminutive, Masha. She came. Now, that's not unusual. Putin's been known to do that. But what was unusual is she came back right back at him and addressed the Russian head of state by his diminutive, which is usually used for children, close friends, family members, as Vova. Now, this bit went viral on the internet. This went viral on the internet and for good reason. In the past, it would have been unthinkable for a journalist to address Vladimir Putin in public as Vova. I'm not even sure he lets his wife call him Vova. Let's listen to this clip.
Ответьте, пожалуйста.
Как вас зовут, да?
Мария меня зовут.
Мария?
Мария.
Маша, садись, пожалуйста.
Спасибо, Вова.
Mark, what do you make of that? I mean, this thing did go viral. Are we making too much of it? I was kind of taken back by this exchange.
I don't think it's something we're making too much of, because precisely I think it's a symptom. One journalist getting involved in one little exchange is no big deal. The big deal is precisely, firstly, that the journalist felt that she could, and good for her. Secondly, to the best of my knowledge, she's still an employed journalist.
I saw her on television last night, so yes.
Yeah, exactly. So, which again is in some ways quite significant. And I think it reaches to, I mean, I think Kirill made a really good point by saying this has been regarded as a triumph for Peskov rather than for Volodin. Because anyway, the press secretary's job is just to create a single confected package that at the time looks good, whereas Volodin has to think about the big picture and the long game. And precisely, in big picture terms, this was a press conference like all the others. But in all these other little symptomatic ways, it showed how far the ground has changed. So in some ways, I think this particular exchange is definitely, it's a fascinating little, an insight that shows us the bigger trends that have been taking place within Russia and the fact that the king now is no longer such a powerful monarch.
The other thing I took away from it is this wasn't just the Putin show anymore. This used to be the Putin show, and everybody else was a prop, asking, why are you such a great leader, Vladimir Vladimirovich? And now the journalists were actually, if not stars, the co-stars in this drama. And so Putin had to share the stage. And if you push the metaphor farther, he had to share the stage with civil society in that sense. If you consider the journalists, the opposition journalists who are asking the tougher questions, if you consider them surrogates for civil society in this setting, it does in a way show how the landscape is changing. Kirill, what was your first of all, your reaction to the Spasiba Vova exchange?
It's very funny, but let's try to deconstruct the situation. This brief exchange of the words between two people. This story has a prequel. Because this journalist, she's from Far East, Maria, she was trying to tell him about several very bad things about, governmental policy towards Far East, about the real situation after this summit in Vladivostok. And it's very important. And he was, not very happy with all these words. Mm-hmm. Not information. Of course, he knows everything about this, I think. I hope so. but anyway, he was not very confident in himself in this situation. Secondly, this Maria, she is not a liberal journalist. We had several interviews with her 2 or 3 months ago when we had a special project on in Russian service radio for Europe, Radio Liberty, about Far East. And we conducted an interview with her, and she's, a very strong but regional and not liberal or oppositional journalist, speaking, mildly.
Mm-hmm.
Third thing, intonation of his reply. Садись, Маша. Take a seat, Masha. It's like he was trying to play a school teacher, and she played a school teacher also, which he took for a student, and that was a psychological situation in this case. He was trying to be a master. Yeah, and she put him on his proper place. Just another one human being, and that's all. And that is very important. It's not about social position. It's not about age. It's all about a lack of discipline in Putin's behavior.
One thing that actually I think may have been going on here, maybe not, is that this all was part of Putin's rebranding, to let it get like this. I thought it was very interesting. The first question went to Snob. It was a question about the anti-Magnitsky bill. It was a very assertive question. Now, the first question is never an accident, right? The first question is something that Peskov completely controls, of course. Was this all part of Putin's rebranding, Mark? What do you think? The Kremlin wanted it to go this way to kind of rebrand the president a little bit.
Difficult, because precisely on the one hand, yes, the first question one would expect any half-competent press person to have managed to sort of ensure they knew what was coming. But then I can't help thinking, then why didn't Putin give a good answer? That would have precisely been the point. I mean, unless the notion of branding is precisely not just a kinder, gentler Vova, but also a dumber one, it seems hard to see actually how this plays into creating the narrative. And I think to an extent, what we also saw was an extension of Putin's arrogance. Again, I just thought that he probably felt that he was going to be able to just sit there presumably with his little earbud feeding him whatever statistics he needs to know. and he would be able to manage it the way that he's been able to manage similar events. Because, let's be honest, if you look at what actually came out of this, if we're thinking of trying to consider this to be a rebranding exercise, I'm not convinced that it showed Putin sort of at all willingly sharing the limelight with anyone. Putin's own perspective seemed to be very much not just sort of exalting the stability that is sort of vital for everything, which is always his mantra, but it was very much about himself. Medvedev scarcely got a look in, except implicitly in terms of a few barbs that were in there. You know, it really did underline for me the extent to which actually sort of Putin's message is l'état c'est moi, that the everything is about him, that the power vertical has become this Putin vertical. And in that respect, everything therefore depends on his own abilities to charm or command. And okay, I'm sure there are some who were charmed or commanded in that room. But in terms of the impression that's presented outwards, for me, it actually shows a machine that is no longer able to maintain its control over its own country. So no, I mean, I could be wrong. There could be some deep Machiavellianism at work, but I can't help thinking that I don't believe it. Mm. I think this was actually not an attempt to rebrand. This was an attempt to assert an old brand.
Uh-huh.
Frankly, whose sell-by date, I think, is increasingly visible.
That's an interesting way to look at it. I expected it to be an attempt to rebrand, and I was wondering if this was maybe how part of the whole rebranding process. Maybe I'm giving the Kremlin way too much credit for being that clever. Mark, you wanted to jump back in?
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to say, because I think it's always good to sort of acknowledge our mistakes, I thought it was going to be a rebranding too, just as actually I thought the State of the Union was going to be a chance for Putin, that I thought actually Putin would try something dramatic. Because in both cases, to be honest, they've really been flagged up in advance as if we should expect something new and different. You made the point about the extraordinary publicity that took place before this event. And I almost wonder, and this is pure speculation, if precisely right up to the 11th hour, there was internal debate going on about which direction to take it. But that at the final moment, Putin actually had a crisis of nerve and decided to stick to old Putin rather than new one. Which again would fit his character in that he is not a gambler. And I think probably he therefore decided that it was a safer bet, and I think he's wrong.
Yeah, and I would add that the hype for this went beyond the trailers that were, again, like Hollywood trailers that I posted on the blog this week that were on all the Russian state channels. There was also a program. It was utterly bizarre from my point of view. A program before and on the day before as well, where they were kind of playing Putin's greatest hits from previous press conferences, and linguists were analyzing the things he was saying. I mean, this was I had never quite seen this done with a press conference before, but it was, and then they replayed this program right before the they went live. Yesterday, they had this whole kind of replay of, you know, the best of Putin's press conferences from the past with analysis of his language, of his quips, his funny use of language. Another thing that jumped out at me yesterday was that the difference between the journalists from the regions and the journalists from Moscow. And not just that the journalists from the regions tended to be more servile, although they did. But the journalists from the regions were asking about very specific regional development, regional economic. They were correct. They're good questions in terms of like things that were happening. But Putin was very comfortable with these. He was very prepared to answer these. It's easy for him to. And these weren't just the, you know, can't we have a national day for accountants, or can we name the Kuril Islands after you? There were questions about economic development and things like that, as opposed to the Moscow journalists who were concerned with the big questions like the fate of political prisoners, like the adoptions in the anti-Magnitsky bill and so on. So this you also began to see the split in society as well. Kirill, did you pick up on that as well?
Usually there are two ways of, you know, conducting this press conference during, you know, Putin's rule. First, the first one is Putin as in Russian is начальник партхоза актива. So a head of, you know, Communist Party, you know, economical department. Right. Yeah? And the second one is a press conference of a big politician or national leader or, you know, Moscow leader and so on. First role is a role of, you know, good czar. Yes, good, benevolent czar, who is in charge of, you know, every tractor in every kolkhoz. And the second intonation, second role is like a very tough Hollywood guy.
Right.
I'll be back in this sense. So he's returning, and all this, you know, all this role which he played, tried to play yesterday, he was just returning, but returning not to provincial Russia as a leader of all Russia. He's returning to Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
He's returning to a place of Vladimir Putin. He tried to reinvent himself like a Putin, Moscow, well-known, tough leader. And that was, returning to your first question, that was not a rebranding.
Mm-hmm.
Because I fully agree with Mark, because about this word, this is a key word, ability. He is not able to be rebranded or to rebrand himself. He has no, you know, such, you know, talent.
So it's like new Coke. You couldn't.
Yes.
It was a dismal failure when they tried to rebrand Coke.
Yes. He cannot. He cannot do this. Of course, I am absolutely sure that all his, you know, aides and so on, they would be happy to reinvent him, to rebrand him, to make him, you know, in some sense more liberal, or maybe in some sense more tough and so on. But he cannot, because he can play only Vladimir Putin all the time long. And he can go on with this role just with regional Russia, not with provincial Russia, but not with Moscow. And that was the division, not the division between regional Russia or provincial Russia and Moscow. That is the division between two Putins, two roles. And that is crucial, because he cannot no longer play this, you know, good czar role for Moscow.
For Moscow.
Public.
But he still can play it for the provinces.
And his new role for Moscow journalists and Moscow, you know, liberal Tusovka and so on, is now, from now on, is very damaging for his image in the Russian province. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the problem.
Mark, did you pick up on the difference between the way the regional journalists and the Moscow journalists acted, and did you come to any conclusions from that?
Yeah, and I think reflects two things. One is precisely this issue of the Kremlin's loss of control over the national conversation, and also the issues that matter within that national conversation. As you said, they were raising very, very specific local issues, which in the past was always often where Putin excelled, you know, the same way as he would often metaphorically, I'm sure he'd like to do it actually, parachute into some regional city with some big local problem, and he'd demonstrate his complete command of it, and he'd fix it. He'd suddenly sort of decree that money would be available to do X or Y. He's not been able to do that. He's not been able to use that as a tool. So I think it reflects the extent to which regional powers are becoming unhappy with what's going on in Moscow. Mm-hmm. But the second point is, yes, we're seeing an evolution of the media generally. It's coming under a lot of pressure from Moscow, and pressure cracks many things, but it also makes diamonds. And therefore, I think that some of those journalists out there, whether they're liberal or non-liberal, and I was interested in what Kirill said about our Vova friend, but one way or the other, though, they are in many ways becoming better journalists, precisely because they operate in a rather more restrictive environment.
Well, I want to play another clip from one of the journalists who emerged as a co-star in this drama with Putin. Let's listen to a clip of journalist Ilya Azar from Lenta.ru sparring with Putin over the fate of people who are still in detention over the protests of May 6th and the eve of Putin's inauguration. And we have edited these clips down for digestibility, just so everybody knows. We're not hearing the full exchange, but let's listen.
Don't you think it is time to turn the mercy and spiritual foundations that you talked about to the detainees in the Bolotnaya case?
It is absolutely unacceptable to raise one's hand against a representative of the authorities. You probably have a lot of respect for the legal system of the United States. Try to pull something out of your pocket over there, and you'll get a bullet in your head with no questions asked, and the police will be acquitted.
Kirill, what did you make of that? That was a pretty hot exchange over the arrest of the political prisoners. Azar came at Putin saying, you spoke in your speech of spiritual values. How do these spiritual values apply to these political prisoners that were arrested on Bolotnaya Square on after the May 6th protests? Putin comes back at him and says, you probably have a lot of respect for the U.S. justice system. What do you think would happen in America if they behaved this way? What did you make of that exchange? That was pretty
It's a very interesting and very, you know, an important exchange if we try to interpret this. Question was very good because he, sent Putin from heavens of his mythological ideas about all this spirituality and so on to the ground. To the ground about the real reality of persecution of those who opposing him. But for me, the answer is more interesting because, first of all, as it's happened very often, Putin is lying, just lying. And it's very interesting that no one tries to catch him. Just at the moment when he's lying, telling lies about this, legal system in the United States and so on. Because all his information, it's very interesting, all this piece of information about the American law, American policemen and so on, he borrowed from Hollywood movies.
Yeah, right.
It's very interesting. This is an image of a kind of Hollywood America where policemen can, shoot you at once when you're just moving, on the first move. Secondly, this is a very interesting and very vulnerable psychologically position of Putin. He cannot answer the direct question. He's trying to pass this question to some Americans somewhere. And it's very interesting that he decided that Len Theroux, maybe it's American media. No, it's not American media. Len Theroux is a well-known, established Russian media. So we can just suppose that Putin never opened Russian internet. And that is a very interesting, hint about his inner world, his psychological world, and about his, political and human limitations. He cannot answer the direct question about several things or some things, a lot of things, which he has no idea about them.
Well, it was interesting that Azar came at him with a very Russian approach to this. These spiritual values, these orthodox values you talk about. How did this apply to your treatment of political prisoners? And what is, Putin comes right back and plays the America card with him, which I thought on both sides that was very telling. Mark, what did you take from that?
Yeah, the fact that Putin plays the America card, it's not after all unusual. I mean, we're used to whataboutism. You ask me about this, and they say, but what about slavery? But we're used to that when dealing precisely with criticism from abroad. You foreigners dare criticize us, but look at what you're doing. When actually you have the head of state in Russia answering a question from a Russian journalist about events in Russia and somehow invoking America as some kind of yardstick whereby Russian policy can be measured, it does say rather bizarre things about where he feels legitimacy lies. I mean, if the best he can offer is, you think things are bad, but trust me, things are bad just over the border, I mean, that's essentially the kind of line that you get in places like Belarus and Uzbekistan. It's hardly the sort of legitimating narrative that you'd expect of an elected head of state of an emerging and powerful country. So again, I think it does say some interesting things about Putin feeling assailed, and precisely the fact that he wasn't picked up on this, and I think Kirill's quite right. Now, apart from the fact that I certainly wouldn't have the guts to turn around to Putin and tell him that he's lying. But also the whole point is the format of this event was not geared to really encourage or even allow that. You know, this event was essentially created to be an audience, not a conversation. And therefore, I think this is the problem, is that Putin can say these things that are outright falsehoods or just, you know, whether it's he doesn't know any better or he knows full well, but just simply says something that he knows is untrue. Either way, he can say them and then move on. The thing is, that doesn't advance the debate at all, and that also doesn't really educate Putin in the slightest. I think this is it. He's closing himself more and more within the bubble of his court and his friends and such like. It may well be that exactly all he knows about America is based nowadays on action movies and intelligence briefings, probably equally fictional, and that no one actually tells him when he's off beam.
Before we move on, I want to get very briefly from both of you, just a couple of sentences. What's the main thing we learned from this event about where Russia is right now and where it may be going? Kirill.
It's a very sad situation because it's a very grave situation because the leader of the country still cannot and doesn't want to understand his own, you know, society. Mm. And that is the main outcome of all this event.
Mark?
Yeah, that Putin has absolutely nothing new to offer in late 2012, and really he's coming on as if it's 2002. Stability is his watchword, and everything else must just take second place to that. That's no place for Russia to be in.
And for what it's worth, my two cents is we heard about this supposed rebranding weeks ago in this, with this leaked Kremlin document, but apparently Met policy has been abandoned. We've seen the State of the Nation speech. We've seen the annual press conference. I don't see any rebranding, so I guess that appears to be off the table unless they're going to roll it out in the new year. In a few moments, Mark, Kirill, and I will continue our discussion and zero in on a bill passed today by the State Duma that's causing a stir in Russia. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague is Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City is NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher Mark Galliotti, author of numerous books on Russia and author of the must-read blog In Moscow Shadows. I'd like to remind you, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. You could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
You will agree with me that in America, in any case, they will be better off. You said they'd be better off. But we know about some tragic cases, such as the case when a child was left in a car and died from the heat of the sun. Is that better or worse?
That was Sergei Loiko of the Los Angeles Times sparring with Putin at yesterday's press conference over a law that was passed in its third reading in the State Duma today, prohibiting U.S. citizens from adopting Russian children. The bill was in retaliation for a U.S. law denying visas to Russian officials who violate human rights, which itself was passed in response to the 2009 death in pre-trial detention of Russian attorney Sergei Magnitsky. The Russian bill has sparked fierce opposition in society and on social media, with critics alleging that it is using children, Russia's most vulnerable children, as pawns in the Kremlin's tit-for-tat with Washington. The United States is the leading foreign adopter of Russian children, with American families last year alone adopting 956 children, including 89 with serious physical or mental disabilities. The bill's defenders point to the 9 adopted Russian children who have died in the U.S. over the past decade and argue they are protecting the rights of children. Kirill, you and I were speaking off mic about this at length a couple of days ago, and you called this legislation a major blunder that will cost the Kremlin dearly. Why don't you fill in our listeners about why you think this is the case and what you think the consequences may be?
First of all, I'll speak about all this problem not as a human being, but as an expert, so-called expert.
You're ceasing being a human being at this moment.
Yes.
Kirill has turned into an android in the studio before my eyes.
We told a lot.
We're talking about children here. We have to talk about them as humans.
Yes, because from the human point of view, this legislation is awful, disastrous, and criminal. And that is my point. But I try to, set aside.
Detach your emotions.
Yes. And I try to speak, from distance and mm-hmm. like an expert, not, So I think that that is one of the gravest political mistakes of United Russia and Duma. Political thinkers or maybe the people around Putin for years and years and years. Because main electoral base of Putin's regime is middle-aged provincial Russian women. Those who are concerned with children, with everyday life, and who knows this life in reality, in utter reality of very hard Russian provincial, so I'm stressing provincial mm-hmm. life. And all of them, they know everything about the situation with these children who could be adopted from some other countries. And they know pretty well their fate, the fate of these children, if they will not be adopted from their citizens from some other countries, or maybe from some, good, wealthy, quite wealthy Russian people. So all of these people know that this fate will be not tragic, maybe, I hope so, but dramatic. And when this so-called parliament decided to make a blow, not to, some Americans, some liberals, some opposition and so on, but their aim is children who cannot defend themselves.
Their intended aim was America, but the collateral damage was the children.
The outcome from the point of view of, usual, ordinary Russian, middle-aged woman from provincial city or town or village maybe, is a blow to these defenseless children. These MPs, they are stealing their future. And that is a very serious situation for, the very image of United Russia as a so-called People's Party. It's not from now on a People's Party. It's not from now on a kind of, substitute Popular Front for Russian politics and Russian society and so on. This is, from now on, this is a bunch of cynical politicians who are absolutely, absolutely cold to the fate of their own people. And having in mind that this provincial Russian middle-aged women, they are the core electorate base of Putin's regime and United Russia itself, this is a very serious blow to them. And that's why this decision inflicts such anger, not just in Moscow.
It's all over
Russia.
And not the usual suspects. It's not the people who are tending to be against the regime.
By the
way,
one of the very disturbing question which was asked during this press conference, it was asked by a journalist of Argumenty i Fakty.
Yes.
Argumenty i Fakty is a popular, of course, not like opposition, it's not political at all.
No, it's pro-Kremlin,
it's pro-Kremlin newspaper. And that is not a political game. That is quite, quite clear that this particular journalist was absolutely in anger.
No, the opposition to this is heartfelt. It's not a political game. It's definitely heartfelt. And it kind of took me by surprise because I thought all of the focus on these was 9 children who have died in the U.S. in the last decade
19,
because they were unfortunate enough to be, adopted into bad situations. But we're talking over 900 children being adopted just last year, including 89 with serious physical or mental disabilities that, I don't know what their fate would be if they were left in Russian orphanages, these children.
Yes. And moreover, it's very serious in the context of recent political situation, because as we told last week, the protests of 2012 is calming down. There is no, kind of unity in the Russian opposition, yes? And that is a very, not a very, but rather good situation for the authorities to go on with some kind of policy and so on. And what do we see? We see that Russian Duma invented a reason for a public anger, just invented from the zero. And after that, this anger is spreading all over the country. So, of course, it's not revolution and demonstrations and so on. But anyway, public image of all the authorities, including Putin, who supported this idea during press conference, yeah, is damaged. And that is very serious. That's my opinion.
Mark?
Yes, the Kremlin has managed to put itself in a position where, again, if we're following the movie analogy, it's the fleeing criminal who cornered, grabs a kid, puts a gun to its head and tells the cops, back away or the kid gets it. The thought of regarding, well, you're trying to punish our corrupt officials, well, we'll show you, we'll also corrupt our vulnerable orphans. It's clearly a ridiculous and asymmetric and disproportionate response. I'm not quite so convinced that it's a big deal in the long term. I mean, though I'm much less in touch with the loamy depths of the Russian salt. Well, certainly it's clear that at the moment it's definitely a cause celebre. I'm not convinced that necessarily 4 months hence it'll be a big deal. For me, one of the big take-homes was precisely that this was not essentially a Kremlin initiative. If you look at the sort of the key central players, I mean, Medvedev doesn't seem to show great enthusiasm for it. The foreign ministry isn't happy.
Lavrov's come out against it.
Exactly. Putin, he's given vaguely positive sounds, but again, he has also inserted these uncharacteristic weasel words, saying, well, I haven't actually looked at all the detail of this extraordinarily short bill. And I said, he was asked about it eight times he had the opportunity to come out and just simply say, well, of course, it's absolutely necessary, and he didn't. And it's precisely the fact that this came out of United Russia, this came out of the Duma. We're very unused to initiatives coming out from United Russia that aren't choreographed by the Kremlin, but this was one. And it's more that the Kremlin sort of feels that it can't really say no, because at the moment it needs to have something to sort of shore up that particular sort of wing of its support. So for me, this says something again about the lack of ideas in the Kremlin, and in some ways, even amongst its own support base, a lack of an ability to actually control the conversation, and thirdly and finally, a lack of sympathy with the general zeitgeist of the Russian population. This is by no means the old Putin and the old Putin Kremlin.
There was something else that also should be noted, is that I read this somewhere on the internet where Dmitry Peskov supposedly during the press conference was very annoyed. You mentioned, Mark, the eight times Putin was asked about this. Peskov was very annoyed that journalists kept asking about Magnitsky, and he was allegedly texting journalists saying, why are you asking about this so much? So they really were, it appears, if that report I read was true first, and it appears that they were taken back by this. They didn't expect this, which is mind-boggling, because anybody paying attention to anything has to know that there was going to be a lot of questions about this. In terms of this being a United Russia initiative and not the Kremlin, I mean, the Kremlin did want some kind of response to the Magnitsky bill, which was passed in the United States Congress and signed by President Barack Obama, which was in response to the death of Sergei Magnitsky in pretrial detention. And that bill was passed in coordination with lifting the Jackson-Vanik Amendment, a longstanding demand of the Russian Federation. But there was going to be some response to Magnitsky. What I'm surprised is the Kremlin let this be it, because suddenly the conversation has turned to this. It's not about the Kremlin reacting to the U.S. passing the Magnitsky bill anymore. The whole thing is turned to this, and that's just an incredible blunder from the Kremlin's point of view.
And moreover, sorry for interrupting you. Moreover, it's the second case when children were used as hostages in political game. The first one was in Beslan, around Beslan, not in Beslan. Of course, that was the real hostages.
Right.
But when after Beslan, Duma passed the legislation about cancel the election,
gubernatorial elections,
and so on, they used children to express their political ideas and so on. And secondly, yes, in 2012, they used children to try to respond somehow to America. And that are the things that, which I'm absolutely sure that Russian population never forget. Never forget, because children, it's a special issue in public consciousness.
So you think this could be one of those tipping points then?
I think so, because now Russian MPs in Duma, they stigmatized by this decision. And that's no coincidence that just after the voting in Duma about this anti-Magnitsky bill, so on, Russian internet was full with list of MPs
who voted for. Yeah.
And that is very important, because now it's not like, you know, some Duma. They're real people with real biographies and so on. And that is very serious.
Now, I didn't look at the final roll call today and the third reading, which is the
same,
final
absolutely.
Reading. It was the same.
Yeah.
So we still had Just Russia was still yeah. supporting this.
And it's very interesting that so-called opposition parties, they supported this legislation.
Right.
That is very interesting.
Now, this again, as I noted, was in response to the Magnitsky bill in the U.S. Mark, what do you make of the tit for tat between the Russians and the Americans over the whole Magnitsky affair?
Well, I think again, obviously, Moscow has locked itself into a position that it had to respond. It tried to basically through outrage overawe the White House. And generally sort of the American political system, and get them to back away from the Magnitsky bill. I mean, regardless of the virtue of the Magnitsky bill overall. Having done that, though, they locked themselves into a position in which they had to respond. And what, to me, it really emphasizes is actually how weak Moscow's position is in this case. I mean, they were looking at alternatives. They, for example, were thinking about finding some kind of blacklist for people who are involved with the extradition of Viktor Bout, the Russian arms
right.
dealer. But again, I mean, that would have been a very sort of technical issue. The point is that the Magnitsky bill is, on the whole, hitting people who, it is known, have large amounts of money and may well want to spend that or travel in the United States. In other words, it actually hurts people who are really going to be hurt.
Or who have that money in Western banks.
Precisely. A Russian bill that was perhaps, you know, targeting DEA agents. Well, it's unlikely that many of them are currently buying dachas outside Moscow anyway. So time and again, I mean, what this shows is actually that Russia's biggest card has often been, you want us to be on your side, that we can make life very inconvenient for you. And I think the point is that the Russians are realizing that that actually is a card that you can only play so many times. To broaden this out, we're beginning to see this with Syria. It's having been so intransigent for so long. Russia is clearly now looking for a way in which actually it can back away from its position. Because currently at the moment it becomes identified as Assad's best friend. So, you know, it really emphasizes to me that there is a sense of limiting options in Moscow. And if they wanted to have some kind of response to the Magnitsky Bill, what could they say that wasn't actually going to hurt Russia more than it hurt anyone else?
Right. Now, I expected some pro forma blacklist, like you said, maybe connected with Viktor Bout's extradition, maybe, you know, targeting some whatever congressman or American officials who would never travel to Russia. Anyway.
I can imagine American prosecutor who keeps money in the Russian Sberbank,
right,
for instance.
Right. But I expected something pro forma out of this. What was really telling for me was Sergei Lavrov coming out against this, and that.
It's an international document.
First of all, another thing that needs to be noted is that an adoption agreement that just went into force is in effect between the United States and Russia. And if I understand the language of this bill correctly, the foreign ministry now has to inform the United States that Russia is pulling out of this agreement. And then in 1 year's time, the agreement will go out of force, which will allow
that
adoptions.
That's what Sergei Mironov told today. Yeah.
So adoptions that are in process now will be. And we still, you know, Putin called it appropriate response, emotional but appropriate was his exact words yesterday. So he, in a sense, gave his support to the bill. But we still don't know if he's going to sign it. It's possible he may not sign this.
I'm absolutely sure that he will sign it.
That he will sign it?
Yeah,
well, then,
absolutely.
And then it doesn't.
I can bet.
It doesn't truly go into effect for another year's time. And that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFURL. In the studio with me has been Kirill Kobrin of RFURL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from New York City has been NYU professor and longtime Kremlin watcher, Mark Galliotti, author of the must-read blog, In Moscow Shadows. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russian Police Watch, which you can follow and should follow at Rus Police Watch. This was our last podcast of 2012, but we'll be back again next year on January 11th, to be exact. In the meantime, happy holidays to all. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.